This podcast is supported by Mercy Corps. From war in Ukraine to flooding in Pakistan to earthquakes in Afghanistan, Mercy Corps is delivering urgent humanitarian assistance and long-term solutions to families in crisis around the globe. Visit mercycorps.org/donate to learn more and support lasting solutions in over 40 countries. That's mercy, corps.org/donate to help build a future where everyone can flourish.
Hey, Run-Up listeners, we're going to do something different on Election Day, a call-in show. As we wait for the results, me and the other members of the politics team will answer whatever questions you have about the candidates, the issues, the polls, and about reporting on this totally bananas campaign. Want to ask Amy Chozick about life inside Clintonland? Or Jim Rutenberg about how Trump changed the news media? Or me about the making of this show? You can leave us a voicemail at 347-868-7110. That's 347-868-7110. Or you can send us an email at therunup@nytimes.com. That's all one word, therunup@nytimes.com. And please include your phone number in the email.
I think it's fair to say this is not your typical election.
I've got to use some Tic Tacs just in case they start kissing her.
He has said that the video doesn't represent who he is, but I think it's clear to anyone who heard it that it represents exactly who he is.
Putin, from everything I see, has no respect for this person.
Well, that's because he'd rather have a puppet as president of
no
the United
puppet,
States.
No puppet.
And it's pretty clear.
You're the puppet.
It's pretty clear you won't admit
no,
that
the
Russians have engaged in cyber attacks against the United States of America.
I will totally accept the results of this great and historic presidential election if I win.
From the New York Times, this is The Run-Up. I'm Michael Barbaro. So many questions about how 7 days out from the election, we're somehow talking about the FBI, Hillary Clinton's emails, and an investigation that was supposed to be closed. Today, we're breaking this complicated situation down into three parts. One, what is actually happening here? Two, why did FBI Director James Comey wait until now to notify Congress of the newly discovered batch of emails? And three, could this revelation change the outcome of the presidential election? For part one, I'm joined by my colleague Amy Chozick, who's been covering the fallout from this inside the Clinton campaign, and Michael Schmidt, who broke the original story about Clinton's private email server back in 2015, and who is tracking the newest investigation. Amy, Michael, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having us.
So I want to talk about the circumstances under which these emails were first discovered and when. So, Michael, tell us.
So the FBI was investigating Anthony Weiner to determine whether he had exchanged these illicit text messages with this young girl in North Carolina. So as part of that investigation, they got his electronics and they got a phone and an iPad and a laptop. And they're going through the laptop and they say, uh-oh, this looks like Hillary Clinton-related emails. These look like emails that Huma Abedin had on the server or may have had during her time at the State Department. And that all of a sudden goes back to headquarters, and they say, hey, guys, what do we do with this?
So when was that?
So that was at the beginning of October. Around October 3rd, the FBI gets the materials and starts to go through them. But the problem is that the pace of the Weiner investigation wasn't there was no reason for it to be going any quicker, and there was no urgency to it. So they sort of kicked this back, but they also couldn't look at the emails because they only had the authority to look at Weiner-related emails related to their investigation of the illicit text messages.
So that month delay, though, to some people, that just inevitably feels political, even if that's just kind of retrospective doubt, right?
That's, I think, the FBI's biggest problem here is that everything they do is seen through a political lens, and everyone thinks that they're trying to put their thumb on the scale. And that's what they've run into, obviously, here with what Comey did on Friday. And, you know, as everything goes back and gets scrutinized, they're going to say, why, you know, why this, why that? The interesting argument would be if it came out, let's say, at the beginning of October that the FBI was in possession of these. Comey did what he did at the beginning of the month. Would that have had a worse or a more substantial impact on Clinton?
Amy, what was the Huma Abedin, Anthony Weiner electronic arrangement there on Park Avenue South, as best we understand it?
Well, there's been some misinformation. We're not completely sure if they were sharing these devices. Do spouses share devices? No,
I don't.
But so we're not sure if they shared them, if he knew her password and got into them. We're not exactly sure what the situation was. But whatever the arrangement, apparently thousands of emails pertaining to Hillary Clinton's State Department were on devices that were in the home that obviously Anthony Weiner was also using.
And what could these emails be?
Well, you know, the Clinton campaign has been repeatedly reminding us that they could be duplicates. They could be nothing. They could be, arranging Hillary Clinton's yoga classes. So we don't really know. But I think that her political critics say they could prove the quid pro quo with foundation donors or any of these sort of things that critics have said happened in her State Department, that they've never really found that smoking gun in any of the emails that had been handed over. So they think, is this the trove that shows us what was really happening there?
Because the thing is that a lot of emails were deleted from the server. The FBI was able to get a lot of them, find them, sort of through painstaking process.
Mm-hmm.
But so what the question here would be is that are there— you know, at the end of the FBI's investigation, there were gaps in the emails, that there were some emails they couldn't get back, they couldn't recreate. Are there emails that Huma has that fill in those gaps?
Who could conceivably be accused of wrongdoing from the new batch of emails, and what would that wrongdoing even be?
Well, so let's say they found dozens of more classified emails. That doesn't really move the ball here, because the FBI did find dozens of classified stuff and no one was charged. What would change here is if there was emails that showed an intent to move classified information outside of government systems or an attempt to obstruct the government's investigation. But simply the discovery of new classified information is not going to change the underlying findings that came out in July from the FBI.
One thing I would say that we know about Hillary and Huma's email relationship is that there's often emails that Hillary just forwards and says, please print. You know, this is her closest assistant, advisor, her everything. So there's a ton of emails that we've seen that have come out so far that are just to Huma, please print. So to Mike's point, did she forward something that was classified or clearly marked classified to Huma?
By the way, Amy, I've literally done this with you. Amy, can you please print this for me?
Please print, yeah.
But we do it in the office. Why is it possible that some of this was going on at home, and that's what's kind of unique and feels different about this?
Is also in the office.
Yeah.
So I think, we're starting in a situation that was unusual, or we wouldn't have had this enormous story that Mike broke in the first place.
Right. Her server was at her home.
Right.
Not where it perhaps ought to have been.
Exactly. And a lot of these staffers, especially her kind of coterie of longtime political aides that came with her to the State Department, had, ClintonMail.com addresses. They were not using the state.gov. So you have forwarded me things from your NY Times to print on my NY Times, and that would be a little bit like we're all in the .gov system. But they were kind of operating outside of it.
And if you're personal email to personal email, you're not getting caught in the government system. You're completely outside of it.
Mike, I want to know why the FBI didn't look at this computer already. Wouldn't it make sense for the aides' computers to be a place you'd logically go to look for missing emails?
So as part of the investigation, the FBI went out and tried to find every electronic device that Mrs. Clinton had or that the aides had, and to go on to them and see whether there was classified information on there. At the end of the investigation, they acknowledged we couldn't find everything. There were phones of Clinton's they couldn't find. There were two missing iPads. So they knew that in the future, electronic devices may surface that had stuff on them. There may have been devices they didn't know about. In this case, it was a laptop that it looks like even Huma didn't know had her emails on it. So we could have things like this come up for years, where the State Department in an old box finds some Hillary Clinton phones and the FBI has to go and look and see if there's classified materials on there. So they knew this at the end of the investigation, but they felt confident that they couldn't show criminal intent, so they didn't have a case.
Amy, I want to move from the kind of legal and investigatory to the political. I want to know why the Clinton campaign and its allies have chosen to go after the FBI and the investigation itself. What's the strategy?
Well, I find this to be a fascinating strategy that really speaks to the Clinton psyche. You know, if you go back to the way that Ken Starr personified every political attack on them, every political adversary was this kind of whitewater, you're turning a mountain into a molehill and going after us. And I think it's very much in the Clintons' character to find a personified villain. And the ironic thing about James Comey now occupying that position is, of course, they were praising him as having the utmost integrity in July when he recommended no criminal charges against her.
Given the importance of the matter, I think unusual transparency is in order. Although there is evidence of potential violations of the statutes regarding the handling of classified information, our judgment is that no reasonable prosecutor would bring such a case.
I think because there's no specifics, they can't dispute the specific charges about the emails. Oh, it wasn't clearly marked classified as they have with other emails because we don't know what's in the emails.
Right.
So the easiest thing, I think, for them right now is to dismiss Comey. And in fairness, he's had bipartisan criticism of some of his handling of this matter, you know, 10 days before an election.
Well, you have to remember that up until Friday, Comey was taking it from the right.
House Speaker Paul Ryan.
It seemed to me as he was going through his case that he was going to recommend prosecution. Only then he recommended against prosecution. People have been committed, have been convicted for far less. And the point is, yes, this certainly does underscore the belief that the Clintons live above the law.
So he was really taking it in from that area. The Wall Street Journal editorial page went after him. There were stories in the New York Post about grumblings of current and former agents. And this has now sort of turned that. The right now, you know, even Donald Trump's, you know, was happy with what Comey's doing.
It took a lot of guts. I really disagreed with him. I was not his fan. But I'll tell you what he did, he brought back his reputation. He brought it back. He's got to hang tough because there's a lot of people want him to do the wrong thing. What he did was the right thing.
And now it's coming from a very unified, you know, Democrats. They're in lockstep as they try and stay together as the election comes.
Well, yeah. So Democrats say that Comey, who is a Republican but was appointed by President Obama, has tried this course correction because he was so criticized by the right, and that has sort of motivated him to now go after them. I would add just one other fascinating political dynamic. Remember when Bill Clinton met with Loretta Lynch mm-hmm. on the tarmac? There's a lot of speculation that Justice Department would be more involved in kind of steering Comey off of this had that meeting not happened and the optics of her being kind of a Clinton plant been so bad.
Yeah, for some in the FBI and the Justice Department, that was a real no-no because on a tarmac in Arizona, Loretta Lynch is getting on the plane of Bill Clinton and meeting with him for a significant period of time. And for people on the far right, it gave them this fodder to really question the Justice Department's impartiality in the investigation.
Right. And that was, I think, June of 2015. And the meeting was on no one's schedule. It was reported by neither side. So inevitably, when people learned about it, they thought, oh, well, how could they not have talked about the investigation?
2016. So this is just weeks before Director Comey goes out and announces to the public the findings of the investigation. And some of the FBI say that Comey actually did that to try and take some of the attention and heat away from Lynch, who had sort of been compromised in the public's eye.
Why was James Comey's letter to Congress so short and so vague? I want to ask you that, Michael. And then, Amy, is there something to the complaint from the Clinton campaign that by releasing such an economical statement, you actually are counterproductively sowing confusion?
Now, I'm sure that some of you may have heard about a letter that the FBI director sent out yesterday. Well, if you're like me, you probably have a few questions about it. It is pretty strange. It's pretty strange to put something like that out with such little information right before an election. In fact, it's not just strange, it's unprecedented, and it is deeply troubling because voters deserve to get full and complete facts. And so we've called on Director Comey to explain everything right away, put it all out on the table.
I don't know why Comey didn't think by the end of the day the whole country would know the whole story. It's just too good of a story that Anthony Weiner, you know, a investigation of Anthony Weiner has led to this. So why was the letter so short? And by the end of the day, it had all leaked out. So it's one of these mysteries of the whole thing, why Comey wasn't more forthcoming with Congress. And that's something that the Clintons have seized on and said, okay, well, give us more details. You can't be this vague. And that's something that Trump has seized on because it allows him to say, oh, look, you know, who knows?
I mean, in fairness, the Clintons and their lawyers, I think, were totally blindsided by this. They didn't know this was coming. They didn't know what it was about. I think they were learning from our reporting all the ties to Anthony Weiner and what was happening. And so, you know, when you're being attacked, you want to know as much information as you can about what they have on you and what's there. And so I think when Hillary Clinton in her press conference called on Comey to get it out there, I think it was from a genuine place of we want to know so that we can get ahead of it or prepare for it. And they just don't. So I think there's a lot of not knowing that I think even Republicans have criticized Comey for. That said, you know, she tried to make it very much partisan. She said he only released this letter to Republicans, which is not true. If you turn to the second page of the letter, congressional Democrats are also listed on that letter. And so, you know, with the Clintons, it's always sort of they have some high ground to stand on, but they've taken it a little bit too far and made it all about politics.
I want to step back even further, Amy, to the grand question of the grand love affair of Anthony Weiner and Huma Abedin and their partnership and role in the Democratic Party. Kind of how far back does that go and how important are they as a unit?
I think we both are just fascinated by this relationship and how it's played out. It's like Chekhov says, when a gun appears in the first act, you're going to see it in the third act, you know, and that's the way Anthony Weiner has sort of been throughout Hillary Clinton's campaign, you know, on the periphery, but a major distraction. Remember when she left the State Department, 70% approval rating, everyone loved her. She just wanted to lay low in Chappaqua, pick up awards, plan her campaign. And then, of course, Anthony Weiner and Carlos Danger in his 2013 mayoral race, which you covered, explodes. And suddenly Hillary Clinton, who's not really connected to this guy, I mean, he's married to her closest aide, but it's her name and all of these sorted headlines. And then again, when Huma announced in August that she was separating from Anthony Weiner after the New York Post showed a picture of him sending an image of his crotch with their 4-year-old child in the bed, I think that was the line too far. And Huma announced she was leaving him. And suddenly, you know, Trump seized on it. He brought up all of Bill Clinton's sexual history. It's just an unwanted distraction for Hillary that was just, I mean, it was just theatrical that it came back now to haunt her in her final days ahead of the presidency when things were looking so good. She was finally showing an air of confidence.
Well, it's kind of like the email, you know, in the email story, in a sense, every time you think the email story is over and she has put it behind her, it comes back. And it comes back in this unprecedented, just, you know, ridiculous way of the investigation being reopened, you know, ridiculous just in the story, the arc of the story. Like, you never would have thought this was going to happen.
Amy, is Huma Abedin's place in the Clinton world, which is so special and enduring, is it now in some kind of danger?
And there's definitely Democrats who have said, why does Huma have to be so visible? Why does she have to be on the road with her? I mean, Huma's a very well-liked, well-respected person, and a lot of people in Clinton's orbit are very protective of her. That being said, I think that there is a sense of, you know, we appreciate how loyal the Clintons are, but when a staffer becomes the story and when a staffer becomes an incredibly distracting story that could, you know, threaten to cost her an election, I don't think it will impact voters that much, but has been a huge distraction. You know, what do you do with that staffer? I mean, you look at, I guess, a parallel in Bill Clinton's world, Doug Band, who was President Clinton's longtime staffer, also started as an intern. And, you know, President Clinton kept Doug around for years. You know, it was very recent that they had sort of a difficult break with him and the foundation, but they are loyal to the people who are loyal to them, and especially those who they've described as surrogate children, as Huma and Doug have been described.
But could Huma work in a Clinton White House?
I think knowing Hillary Clinton and the way she relies on these longtime aides, is she would find a way to have Huma working in her White House. I mean, if you remember, you know, Philippe Reines, her longtime and controversial spokesman, has no formal role in the campaign. He was traveling with her on Saturday whenever he played Donald Trump in her debate prep sessions. I mean, she has a tendency to rely on this coterie of aides whether they have official roles or not.
I want to ask you what the best scenario for Hillary Clinton is about how this investigation unfolds between now and Election Day.
I think best case scenario is that nothing happens. There's 8 days. People are early voting. Nothing happens. I mean, it's not ideal to win the presidency under the specter of an FBI investigation, but I think it's better than if there's a slow trickle. You know, we've been getting these WikiLeaks on John Podesta's emails, and every day it's like, oh, is there a smoking gun in these emails? The last thing they need is another trickle of emails and keeping the – eventually the headlines will move on. We'll get closer and closer to Election Day. I mean, the more this stays in the news, the worse.
See, I think the best case scenario for her is that the FBI figures out very quickly that they're just duplicates and Comey comes out on Friday and says, okay, there's nothing here. That really takes all the air out of this. And it would make Comey look sort of, it would make Comey, you know, look like he really overplayed his hand by going to Congress the way he did.
And what's the best scenario for Donald Trump about how this unfolds between now and November 8th?
They release a bunch of emails that were clearly marked classified. They release an email from some Ukrainian oligarch who gave a lot of money to the foundation and got a secret meeting with Hillary Clinton. I mean, you could come up with a range of issues that Donald Trump would gleefully seize on. But I think you saw, if you watched Hillary Clinton's rally that just wrapped up today, she has tried to regain the attacking Donald Trump mantle. She's tried to put it back on him. She was really attacking his ties to the Russians, basically calling him a plant of Vladimir Putin in our elections. And so she is trying to turn the tables of, look at my opponent.
Just to conclude here, realistically, when will this new investigation end? And could it be the case that the next president, whoever he or she is, ends up having to deal with this in the beginning of next year?
I think that there's an enormous amount of pressure on the FBI to get this done by Election Day. I find it hard to believe that that's going to happen. I think this will at least take several weeks, if not several months. So I don't think we're going to have much clarity on it before next Tuesday.
All right. Well, Amy, Michael, thank you both very much for being here.
Thanks.
Thanks for having us.
This podcast is supported by Tenderfoot TV. Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where the new podcast To Die For begins. Hosted by Neil Strauss, To Die For takes listeners inside the dark and dangerous world of Russian sexpionage, where targets are seduced for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, the producers of To Live and Die in L.A., binge To Die For now on all podcast platforms.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with The New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments. Ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to The New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
Okay, part two. What was Comey thinking when he decided to make this investigation public? It obviously wasn't to win new friends. He's been hammered by Democrats and even some Republicans who see him meddling at a crucial final moment in the campaign. Carrie Cordero has a theory about why Comey made the call that he did. She used to be an attorney at the Department of Justice who specialized in national security and worked closely with the FBI. Carrie, thank you for being with us.
Thanks very much for having me.
So you know that there's been this wave of criticism against James Comey for announcing this investigation within 11 days of the presidential election. You've defended Director Comey for his decision about when to do this and how to do this. Help me understand why you think it was the right decision.
Well, I think what's gotten lost in the immediate outrage at the director is the reasons why he got to this point, and specifically actions that the attorney general took over the summer that kind of led him down this road of unusual public transparency about an ongoing investigation.
Tell me what you mean about the Attorney General, Loretta Lynch.
So this summer, when the director publicly described the reasons for the FBI's decision not to go forward with the case, that unusual transparency was precipitated by the Attorney General's appearance of impropriety as a result of the meeting that she had on the airport tarmac with former President Clinton. And so as a result of that meeting, you know, we all like to think that if we were in that position, we would not take the meeting or our staff would hopefully intervene. But that didn't happen. And so there was a mistake that was made by her having that meeting, given the ongoing investigation. But it's what happened after that that has gotten lost, I think, in the criticism of the director. So the Attorney General had basically two options after that tarmac incident. Number one, she could have recognized that there was an appearance of impropriety, and she could have recused herself from that point forward. She could have said, look, I don't think anything of interest was said in that meeting, but I understand that a bad appearance has been set, so I'm going to officially recuse myself. Sally Yates is in charge. The Deputy Attorney General is now in charge and the decision maker. And I think that would have lessened any existing pressure for the director to be so public about the FBI's findings. Her other option would have been to have taken responsibility in full for the prosecutorial decision to not go forward in the case against Mrs. Clinton. She could have said, look, nothing happened in that tarmac meeting. I was there. There was nothing of interest. I am impartial, and I'm going to be able to fulfill my duties as Attorney General. The problem with the way the Attorney General handled it over the summer is she didn't do either of those things. She said, well, I'm going to accept the decisions of the career folks, meaning the career prosecutors or the FBI. And what that did is that kept the appearance of impropriety, which I think the director was sensitive to, and it also basically abdicated her responsibilities to make the chief prosecutorial decision.
So you're saying the potential appearance of impropriety by the Attorney General would have necessitated or at least motivated the FBI director to be kind of ultra hyper transparent in every step he was taking in the investigation, including the one on Friday where he decided to disclose. You're saying there's kind of, there's basically a direct linkage between
those
two.
Yeah, I think it's been, they're all related. So the letter that he sent to Congress this week was because he had to amend or correct or update what he had testified to Congress about. And the reason that he was in the position of having to testify to Congress was because over the summer, he took the unusual step of publicly announcing the FBI's assessment of the case against Mrs. Clinton.
So part of what seems to add to the weight of all this is that the Justice Department is supposed to be, in theory, nonpartisan. And here, true or not, this incident, this announcement so close to the election, it inevitably has kind of a political dimension. And by your telling, this seems like an effort to restore faith in the kind of legal and judicial process. But it feels like it may not have done that. It may have, in fact, to some degree, done the opposite. You know, it's kind of such a no-win situation.
Well, certainly the decision to be public about an investigation this close to an election does go against longstanding department practice. But I think my sense of it is that he felt that this is an extraordinary situation that warranted departure from that usual practice. Because in a normal public corruption case, say if this was a public corruption case regarding a local official or something like that, then usually the FBI or the Justice Department would not take any particular action on it so close to an election so that they would not have the effect of influence in the election one way or another.
It feels like conspiracy is very much in the air in our country at the moment. A lot of it's fueled by Donald Trump. There's a sense that things are afoot behind the scenes that we can't possibly understand. Do you think that Director Comey would have had that at least somewhat on his brain when he made the decision, you know, to just do full disclosure? Let's just tell the world what's happening so that afterward, if we're ever challenged on it, you know, we will not be accused of being part of a conspiracy, real or imagined?
Well, another factor that might, and I don't have any inside information about what he's thinking on this, but another aspect that might be affecting his decision-making process in this is a broader issue that government leaders are currently dealing with respect to being transparent in the event that information leaks or becomes public, and then they have to explain it afterwards.
Right. Thank you. And, thank you, Russia.
And that, I do think that this perhaps is playing into his decision-making process. Because of these leaks of information, he may have made the judgment that the existence of the new emails that came to the investigative team was going to be revealed anyway, and better for him to be the one to, number one, bring that to the attention of Congress, and two, the public, better for him to do it than for it to get leaked, and then he has to explain after the fact.
Well, Carrie, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me.
Part 3, the big question that sits at the heart of all these other questions. Could this sway the election with just 7 days left? For that, we turn to Nate Cohn of The Upshot. Hey, Nate.
Hey.
How much do you think this latest investigation might actually matter by Election Day?
So I don't think it'll matter that much. And there are two reasons why I think that. The first is it's pretty late, and I think most voters have decided or are in the process of deciding. And the second thing is, you know, we've kind of been through this before. This election has been full of really important news events. The FBI criticized Hillary in July for having a private email. There was all of that stuff after the conventions with Trump and the family of Colonel Khan. There was the audio tape a few weeks ago of Trump bragging about grabbing women and getting away with it. You know, all those things did move the polls, but they didn't fundamentally reshape the race. You know, we were talking about landslides 2 weeks ago, and here we are again talking about tightening. And I think that's because the core underlying dynamic of this election hasn't ever changed. And that's that, you know, majority of voters don't really believe Trump is qualified to be the president. They don't like either candidate. And so when the news is good or bad for their candidate, they become more or less likely to indicate their support. But there has never been a point in this race where Trump has been able to assemble a clear path to victory.
But this is so late, so anomalously late. I wonder if there's even much of a historical analogy for something of this level of trauma so late in a campaign.
It's really hard for me to think of something that's really analogous to this, other than, oddly, everything that's happened in this campaign so far. But if I had to look back for a really late breaking news story that was at least somewhat similar, I would probably fall back on the late revelation in 2000, I believe the Friday before the election, that George W. Bush had been arrested for a DUI 20 or so years earlier.
And what was the impact of that?
Well, that's hard to say. I mean, when something happens that late, you never really get a full round of polling afterwards to even be sure. What I think we can say is that George W. Bush had a lead in the popular vote in national surveys heading into the election, and in the end, he lost the popular vote. Could you argue that that was attributable to the DUI? I suppose. Do I believe that? I don't know. There are certainly people who believe that a lot of evangelical voters stayed home as a result of those revelations, which was sort of an organizing principle behind Karl Rove's decision to pursue the reelection strategy that he did in 2004.
Let's presume for a minute that this somehow does change the equation. What type of voter would be influenced by the news that there is a new and yet incredibly nebulous investigation into an old email issue?
I think that if there were to be any kind of voter who might be swung by this, that I would choose perhaps an undecided Republican-leaning, well-educated Republican who finally says, okay, I guess I'm going to support Trump. Hillary's beyond the pale, or maybe the well-educated Republican who had come to her side over the last few weeks, but now maybe is going to reconsider.
And that gets to this question of trust, right? Because Hillary Clinton has had this incredible problem with trust. But my sense is that number had been improving for her, the percentage of people who viewed her as trustworthy. Is that right?
I think that's right. What I'm more confident in is that her favorability ratings have crept up. That's a question that's asked really consistently by pollsters. you know, more Americans had a favorable view of her coming out of these debates than they did in September. I think it's in the ABC Washington Post tracking poll, which has shown a very tight race over the last few days. They find that Hillary's ratings have declined considerably. The Gallup poll, which is sort of slower because it includes a week's worth of data, much of which is still before Comey's letter, does not show any attenuation or favorability ratings. And we're not going to know for a few more days.
You've told us, and especially last week you told us, that the early turnout vote in states like North Carolina is looking good for Hillary Clinton. The question now is, if there is fallout for her, is it good enough to compensate and overcome?
Yeah, that's a really good, I mean, that's a really good point. Here's how I think of the early voting so far. I think of the early voting as largely validating the expectations of pre-election polls in terms of turnout. So there are, I mean, you can make an argument, for instance, that so far the early voting shows lower black turnout than in 2012. That's true. Most polls showed that, though. But I wouldn't say that the early voting is so good that I would assume that Hillary Clinton would outperform her polls on the basis of turnout if her poll numbers decline over the next week. She could still outperform her poll numbers. I just wouldn't argue that it would be because of the early vote.
Before this happened, Nate, where were the big and important poll numbers? Where do they stand? And if they end up changing, what are you going to be looking at most closely?
You know, over the last few weeks, the national polling has tightened. There was a time when, you know, maybe Hillary had a 7 or 8 point lead and she was up something like 45-38. Since the third debate, Donald Trump's numbers have increased. Now maybe he's at 40 or 41%. Hillary's numbers haven't dropped. So to me, what that indicates is that since the third debate, some number of Republican-leaning voters who have reservations about Mr. Trump have decided that they will ultimately vote for him in November. I think that whether that trend continues is really important because Hillary is counting, to no small extent, on the support of some Republican-leaning, well-educated voters.
When are we going to know whether this was a game changer or not?
That's a good question. So the Comey letter was released on Friday, right?
Right.
So I would be surprised if we had a meaningful amount of data before Tuesday or Wednesday. I think we'll have a clear picture by the end of the week, though.
All right, Nate, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
That's it for The Run-Up. I'm Michael Barbaro. I'll see you back here on Friday.
Over the last 25 years, the world has witnessed incredible progress, from dial-up modems to 5G connectivity, from massive PC towers to AI-enabled microchips. Innovators are rethinking possibilities every day. Through it all, Invesco's QQQ ETF has provided investors access to the world of innovation. Be a part of the next 25 years of new ideas by supporting the fund that gives you access to innovative companies. Invesco QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. There are risks when investing in ETFs, including possible loss of money. ETFs' risks are similar to those of stocks. Investments in the tech sector are subject to greater risk and more volatility than more diversified investments. Before investing, carefully read and consider fund investment objectives, risks, charges, expenses, and more in prospectus at Invesco.com. Invesco Distributors, Inc.